Hello, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. It's Wednesday, the 19th of August, 2009. I'm your host, Herewood Fenton, and tonight we're bringing you a special feature. We're going to be interviewing Dr. Frank Legg from Perth. We've had Dr. Legg on the show before, and last time he came on, he was discussing his research into the collapse of the World Trade Center and the best evidence for the use of explosives in the destruction of those buildings. Tonight we're actually going to be talking about the Pentagon, and this is a subject which has frequently come up as a kind of a divisive issue in the 9/11 truth movement, and it's one which I guess invites debate and confusion, because mainly because there is so little evidence that we have to go on, and only officially provided evidence, the videos of the actual planes which were alleged to have struck the building have never been released. Many people have claimed, from looking at the photographic evidence, that the hole that we have seen in the photographs that we've seen is too small. And it's one of the issues that's been from the very beginning of the 9/11 truth movement. It's been there right from the beginning. One of the first books that ever came out was written by Thierry Masson, who focused on the Pentagon. And so in many people's mind, the questions about 9/11, the whole, you know, if you ask many people, they would say, well, it's all about the Pentagon, because that's often what they've heard. Now, of course, since then, there's been so much more research on so many different aspects of what happened that day, and particularly the collapse of the towers. The main thrust of 9/11 research has actually gone in different directions, but you know, there is still this issue, and it continually comes up. Some people believe very strongly that it was something other than a plane which struck the building. Others say, look, we just don't have enough evidence. And Frank Legg has written a paper which tries to sort of balance up these different views and give the best perspective on the whole thing. So just with that introduction, I'd like to now just welcome Frank to the show. Welcome to the show, Frank Legg.
Hi, Herewood.
Yeah, great. I hope my introduction was acceptable. I'm sort of shooting from the hip a bit tonight, but I just wanted to give a broader perspective there on the question. Frank, would you agree just generally that this question of the Pentagon is sort of it invites confusion and debate because of what we don't know?
Yeah, certainly. I think it's a very tricky question. The case of the Twin Towers, I focus most of my effort on the Twin Towers and Building 7, because there we have clear scientific evidence that explosives were used. Nobody can really argue about it once you study the evidence. In the case of the Pentagon, it's a bit more tricky. We don't have the video, for instance, of the aircraft hitting the Pentagon. If we did, we could calculate its speed and we could see exactly what it was. But we're dependent entirely on eyewitness reports and the official story. Now, the official story says that the speed was 530 miles an hour. We can't prove that, whereas we can prove the speed with which the planes hit the towers. We can't prove it was really 530, maybe it was only 500, maybe it was only 480. And it's quite significant, that kind of uncertainty, because supposing it's impossible to control a plane at 530, but it wasn't really doing 530, but 500. It makes the arguments completely different.
Right. So the actual speed becomes really critical in terms of what is that, because of the aerodynamic aspect, or because of how it would have damaged the building?
It's not really a question of how far it would damage the building. It certainly it's going fast enough to do an awful lot of damage.
Right.
It's really the arguments that have been put up by some people to say that it couldn't have happened, that the plane could not have hit the building. One of the arguments is that it would be impossible to control the plane at that speed. Well, now, if you study the data, you find out that the plane's actually flying at quite a reasonable speed most of the way, about 300 knots or a bit more. It's about 350 miles an hour. Quite a handleable, you know, easy speed to handle. And then there's a number of eyewitnesses who confirm the official story and say that they heard the motors being revved up as the plane was approaching. Now, the plane is on a descent for landing, coming in at about a normal descent angle. Now, normally when a plane is coming in to land, it's got its flaps extended, it's got its wheels down, it's got its power pretty well off, and it maintains speed. But if this plane is coming in with its flaps retracted, its wheels retracted, and it's suddenly put on to full power, and it's descending, it's going to accelerate very rapidly.
Okay.
Now, supposing it did hit at 530, only a couple of seconds before, it would only be doing about 480 or 450. So even if they lost control of it in the last couple of seconds, it's not going to be possible to deflect it from its course. It's just going to keep going. And so, you know...
Okay, so this
a lot of these arguments just fall flat when you look at them.
So the issue of the ground effect, which was brought up a number of times, that the plane would have not been able to do that approach because it would have just bounced off due to the aerodynamic effect of the ground effect.
It's complete nonsense.
Okay.
Anybody who has learned to fly an aeroplane knows that when you land, you have to pull back on the control column before touchdown.
Right.
If you don't, you hit the runway with a terrible impact.
Right, right.
You know, the first thing the pilot has to learn is how to stop the plane from coming down. If ground effect was significant on a descending aircraft, the pilot wouldn't have to do anything. The plane would just hover above the runway. It doesn't. If the pilot doesn't pull back on the control column, it's going to smack down and possibly smash its undercarriage. So the thing is, the fact that the plane would experience some ground effect, I don't deny that,
right?
But it's negligible. And particularly, this plane's coming in at a fantastically high speed. It's only going to experience that ground effect for the last 2 or 3 seconds, not long enough to deflect it, even if it was possible to deflect it. So no, ground effect is a nonsense.
Okay, that's a really interesting clarification, because, you know, I mean, I'd heard that argument before, and it sounded pretty convincing, you know. But I guess that was because they were talking about the plane kind of coming in on a fairly shallow approach. And this is
well,
what...
it
what
obviously I, wasn't, because
right.
the marks on the power pole show that it was really coming in at about an angle of 1 in 20, about 6 degrees, which is very, very close to a normal descent
okay.
for a plane landing, coming into land.
Okay, so it's conceivable that the plane was really just kind of landing. You know, it was like it was just landing where there was no runway.
Basically that, yep.
Yeah. Well, that's a really interesting point. Now, a few other things that have been on my mind, because I did, you know, my own research into this at one time and looked at hundreds of photographs, and I even read the report, the government report that they did. You know, the fact that the, I think it was two-thirds of one wing and one-third of the other wing clearly did not go into the building, and that's kind of conceded in the official report, didn't go into the building and didn't leave a mark on the building either. Okay, how do we explain that? Or is that, do you think that's explainable?
Oh, yes. This was an extremely heavy wall that the plane flew into. It's
right.
A very, very thick masonry wall. Only the heavy parts of the plane would have been able to knock a hole in the wall.
Okay.
But a plane travelling at that speed is going to be completely fragmented if it cannot penetrate. Now, I don't know if you know about the F4 experiment. It was done flying a plane into a concrete barrier.
Yeah, I've seen that. It's quite... It's quite instructive, yeah.
It just turns into dust, really, or, you know, confetti or something.
Yeah.
And So, really, if the 757 did hit the Pentagon and the heavy parts penetrated, what you'd see is two kinds of debris. All the heavy material would push its way through the wall and slide in amongst the support columns of the building.
Right.
With plenty of space. And those parts that were not heavy enough, not strong enough to smash their way through, would be shattered into very small fragments. And they'd just be, you know, thrown around, fly up into the air, they'd scatter very widely. And that's what we see. There are photographs that do show lots of tiny little fragments.
Okay. Okay. So we don't... So the absence of, tail and, large pieces of fuselage on the outside of the building is quite normal if it was traveling at that speed at 530 miles an hour.
I think the heavy parts would be quite capable of pushing their way through. I've had, pardon me, I received an email not long ago from a bloke who was working on the Pentagon the day after 9/11. His job was to search amongst the debris for bodies and moving debris around. And he said he picked up a piece of material. It was a very large piece of material there, which he thought looked like the floor of the, you know, the walkway where you walk up and down between the seats.
Right.
He also said there was something there that was so heavy that it took eight men to carry it out. You know, the thing is that there were large pieces that might well have been a motor, you know, or the core of a motor or something like that. Obviously, they were very large pieces, but they're not to be seen outside on the lawn because their weight was sufficient to force them right in underneath the building.
Right, right. So they're all going to just be pushed right into the building by the incredible velocity, the momentum of the actual aircraft. Even as it's breaking up, all the parts of it are going to... Be drawn into that. Yeah, I mean that certainly, put that way, it certainly makes sense. But you know, there are certain counterintuitive things. I mean, for example, it's been pointed out that the window directly above the impact hole that you can see is completely undamaged, and people have pointed out, well, the tail of the plane would have been higher than that window, and yet that window appears to be completely undamaged, as do all the windows on either side of the actual, you know, impact area. You know, just, it's like, so, you know, it seems incredible, but, you know, obviously, in any kind of event, in any kind of catastrophic event, obviously things don't happen the way you necessarily intuitively expect them to occur.
And also, you know, there's a certain amount of space between the windows. It's conceivable that the fin hit the wall between the windows and didn't hit the window.
Right.
It's also conceivable that the glass was extremely thick. I don't know. But there's also another theory, that is that prior to the impact, or just on impact, there was a big explosion which could have shattered the plane. And if that happened, then you wouldn't expect it to make the marks and do the damage that it might if it was undamaged by an explosion. One of the pieces of evidence for an explosion is the... in that video clip that was released, which shows it as the plane, or no, well, I'm going to say the plane.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't show you what it's hitting, but at the beginning, you see a great white flash, and then in the next frame, you see a red fireball from the fuel. Well, now the white flash is characteristic of an explosion, not fuel burning.
Okay.
And also, you see pieces bouncing across the road up near the video camera. And it's a long way away. How can those pieces have been given such an energy that they will fly that far? It seems highly likely that there was an explosion. Why wouldn't there have been an explosion? I mean, the perpetrators used explosives to bring down the towers. Why wouldn't they have used explosives to destroy the plane for some reason or another? So that would mean that you don't expect to see the marks that you see on a tower. Like on the case of the Twin Towers, you see very, very clear marks where the wingtips hit. But there, the supports, the wall supports, were covered with aluminium cladding. Obviously, aluminium is a wonderful material to leave an imprint, totally different from the masonry of the wall of the Pentagon.
Right, right. Okay, well, that seems like a really good summary of why, I guess a few of the things there of why it seems quite plausible that a plane, could have hit the building.
Yeah, I don't try and say that the 757 did hit the Pentagon. What I say is that if you look at all the evidence, you cannot prove that it did not. There are ways it which it very well might have done, and I think probably did. And what I would like to say to people is that if you can't prove that it didn't, it's a good thing to stop arguing that it didn't, because all it does is create antagonism and dissent and confusion amongst the community.
Absolutely. Look, I'm just going to take a short break here, and we're going to get more into that topic in a moment. So just bear with me. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. Okay, well, here we are with Dr. Frank Legg talking to us from Western Australia. And Dr. Legg, I should have introduced you better. Dr. Legg is a frequent contributor to the Journal of 9/11 Studies, and he's a chemist, a PhD in chemistry, and obviously someone with a long life of, study and science behind him, very important contributor to some really important articles in the investigation of September 11. And we've also got in the studio tonight Dan Collins, who's been on the show a few times. Dan's an inquiring mind. He's got an engineering background, and I'd just like to welcome Dan to the show.
Hello.
Yeah. Now, look, we were just getting into the question there of, the distinction between what we, what might be and what might not be, what we can and cannot prove versus what is, I guess, the most important questions to look at. Because we have burning questions about September 11, the whole event of September 11. And this is the way I like to look at it, a global perspective on it. Because we have burning questions about what 9/11 really was. We were told it was one thing, and yet we saw an agenda being played out that looked like something quite different. And so we don't really want to get bogged down in some question about whether the Pentagon was hit by a missile or a plane. I mean, look, a plane and a missile are very similar in some ways, wouldn't you say, Frank? I mean, a plane is a missile and a missile is a plane. They're both long tubes.
Well, in a certain sense. I mean, but of course, the missile hasn't got wings wide enough to knock over those light poles.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's some vital differences as well. But, I mean, obviously, the building was struck, by a missile of some kind, whether it was a plane acting as a missile or whether it was a missile.
Yeah.
And a plane as a decoy that flew over, which is what's been proposed by the CIT team, the Citizens Investigation Team. Now, look, I'm with you in saying, let's focus on what's really important. And I'll just get a quick opinion from Dan on that. I mean, are you on the map here with us on that, Dan?
Oh, well, I am actually curious. Sorry, Frank, to hear your opinion on that sort of. I was watching that video, and people were saying that the majority of eyewitnesses actually put the flight path of the plane not near the light poles. I mean, are you familiar with that?
A great many eyewitnesses. Somebody's done an estimate of what the various eyewitnesses said. Apparently, there are 89 eyewitnesses who said they saw something hit the Pentagon. Of those, a fairly substantial proportion said it was a passenger plane. And also, a fairly substantial proportion said it did hit the light poles. So I think the numbers are in favour of the 757 hitting the Pentagon. And the wingspan of a 757 is just wide enough to hit the five poles. Some people say that it must have been a smaller plane, but then it wouldn't have knocked down all the poles. If it was 737, for instance, wouldn't have done the damage to the poles. So everything seems to match if it was 757.
Are you familiar with just some of the work that Jack White did on just analysis of the photos? Are you familiar with that controversy?
What did he conclude?
Well, he actually did an interesting thing on the internet, Jack White Studios. But he's been around for years doing stuff on the Kennedy assassination and stuff. But he actually was of the opinion that a great number of almost all of the photos had been completely what he calls photoshopped. And he makes a very, I think, quite a convincing case that, you know, it's like a B-grade movie. There's no continuity director, and like all the photos are staged, and the backgrounds are photoshopped and completely fictional. And, you know, and in one photo there's a prop somewhere, and then in another photo where they're moved, they've changed places, and it's like a crazy, you know, like, you know, it's like some, you know, Night of the Living Dead or something.
But how would you get 17 or 20 or something eyewitnesses to say they saw the plane hit the light bulb?
Well, it wasn't that so much. He was.
You can't Photoshop eyewitnesses.
No, but he was just talking about the photos. The fact that all of the photos seemed like, after a while, you see his point. It looks like a great big crazy joke, like they've just cut and pasted bits of wreckage here and there, and like you know, sometimes the burned out cars have swapped position, or they've moved 100 meters up and down the side of the building. And he makes this point that I think it's fairly, you know, I think he has a point that
I think it mightn't be too hard to go through a few things and say, let's take the thing about moving a car, for instance. Supposing you take a photograph today and the car's in a certain place, and then a few hours later somebody's come along with it and moved the car, and then you insert the photograph of that out of sequence, you could make something look very strange.
Oh, no, I just wondered if you were familiar with it, because, I mean, he makes, I think it's fairly, I guess you'd have to like.
Look, yeah, I think, you know, photographic analysis is always problematic.
The thing that I think about, I have looked at some of your stuff a long, long time ago, and I forget the details, but I concluded in the end that he had an agenda, and I just try and steer right away from anything that isn't easy to prove. Now, in the case of the towers coming down with explosive, I see this real proof there, and that's why I focused on it. And I kept away from the Pentagon for a long time. The only reason why I've come back to look at it again is because I see this huge dissent, this huge conflict between otherwise good-hearted people who are supporting the truth movement, arguing with one another. And I see that playing right into the hands of the perpetrators. My theory is that the perpetrators have deliberately provided false evidence, and perhaps White has picked up some of this false evidence in order to create confusion. Now, my theory is this, that the people who actually did this obviously took a huge risk that they might be discovered and so forth, and they wanted an insurance policy. And I think that the Pentagon confusion is their insurance policy. We know that a lot of people think that the 757 didn't hit the Pentagon, and they don't release videos, they don't give us any evidence that can prove it one way and another, so we're all arguing the point. Now, if it ever happens that the public becomes convinced that something needs to be done, if the public really starts to get to the opinion that a new investigation is called for, and it's likely that that new investigation will lead to convictions, the perpetrators will start to get pretty worried. They don't really want to go to jail. And they will call on their insurance policy. So at the moment the swell of public opinion gets really strong for a new investigation, they will release the evidence that the 757 did in fact hit the Pentagon. And that will throw the truth movement into complete disorganization and disarray, be demoralized. Its credibility with the public will be lost. It will become extremely hard to convincingly prove that, or convincingly demonstrate that explosives were used in the towers. And it might set the whole thing back indefinitely.
Yeah, look, I think you definitely, in my mind, talking, you know, extreme good sense there in saying that. And look, I've actually been in the past far more interested in the Pentagon than I am now. And, you know, it was, I guess I've evolved in my view, which is, you know, I mean, I'm not ashamed of that either. I mean, you can change your point of view.
Of course you can change, because if you've been deceived,
yeah,
you discover you've been deceived,
yeah,
then you will change your mind.
Exactly. Now, I mean, but I do think that there is a major case for something dishonest in the fact that they will not release the videos of all the security cameras, just even a few of them that show clearly the plane hitting it. I mean, you know, and a loud, you know, movement demanding that we should be able to see those images, I think is totally valid, because they should show those images.
Yes, I think it's a perfectly reasonable request to ask to see those videos, and the fact that they do not release them is extremely suspicious, and that's why I developed this theory that it's their insurance policy.
Yes, yes. It's
you know, the number of people that think that the 757 did not hit the Pentagon is very substantial. So they've got the case made for them.
It's
exactly
really
what they want. So if they really become worried that they're going to get prosecuted, they will release the opposite evidence, and everything will be chaos. That's what they want.
Yeah, Frank, that's an interesting theory. I get your point. I read your paper, and I understand what you're saying. But doesn't the photo the photo of the window, the unbroken windows that, you know, gets a lot of airtime. And that was, you know, the unbroken windows was the original thing that propelled, you know, Thierry Messiaen to write his original stuff on the Pentagon, you know, deception. I mean,
that if the plane was destroyed by explosives about the time the nose of the plane arrived at the Pentagon, why would it destroy the window?
So they would potentially claim that they blew it up with a missile before it hit, or I mean, surely that.
How do you know the plane wasn't filled with explosives?
Well, this is part of the terrorist hypothesis, I guess. But I mean, how did the terrorists have time to stuff the plane with explosives?
But that's the whole point. The terrorists didn't do it. How do we even know that Hanny Hanju was on the plane?
But I'm just saying you are saying that they've worked out some watertight explanation. But the problem is that this explanation, I think, would actually lead to more unanswerable questions. Do you see?
Well, what's
So the question
what's
of
what's unanswerable about the idea that they could have loaded the aircraft with explosives?
Well, did the terror? I mean, this is all part of the terrorists. Did the terrorists?
No, it's got nothing to do with terrorists.
But how would you?
This is the authorities.
But how if they?
The CIA.
But if they released the video of the plane blowing up, how would they explain it?
They can't. I see what you mean. If they can't explain it blowing up, they ruin their story.
Well, that's certainly true. Yeah, they would certainly do that. But look, I've just actually got a question about the explosives. If there were explosives in the nose of the plane, but the entire plane is traveling at 530 miles an hour, doesn't that still mean that the mass and the momentum of all that matter is still going to be just surging forward at the same speed? It's just that some of it's going to be, you know, in bits and pieces, but isn't it still going to... How do you get around the impact problem? I still don't see that explaining why... I mean, what was really questioned was the tail of the plane, you know, which is like a, you know, 150 feet the other end of it, which is, and it's also, it's about, the tail's about 100 feet high or something. I mean, the tail's really enormous, right? I'm not sure of my dimensions there anyway, but the tail is high, almost as high as the top of the building. I know that. So that this the tail of the plane makes no mark that you can see in the photos that were taken. And I should stress that these are the photos that were taken before the facade collapsed, and there's only a few of them. But there is no evidence of a mark on the tail. And, you know, as I said, you know, in the beginning, that really fascinated me, and I still don't have an explanation for it. I just don't think I can get much mileage out of talking about it anymore. It still does perplex me, though.
I'll have to have a look at some of those photographs to see what I can see. But
I mean, I would be interested in someone explaining it.
The wingtips of the planes hitting the towers didn't do anything much either. They didn't go in.
Right.
Lots of people say that the planes flew in like butter.
Yeah.
Like a hot, nicely butter. It was complete rubbish. They didn't. Only parts of the planes went in. The ends of the wings did not. And there's plenty of photographs showing lumps of aluminium on the road underneath.
Okay.
So, you know, there's a lot of mythology about this, and there are people saying things which just aren't true, and it only sows confusion. The wingtips of the towers only dented the aluminium. They did not do any damage to the steel. Now, if they couldn't do any damage to the steel, are you sure that a wingtip can do damage to a masonry wall?
Yeah, it is really hard to make a call on any of that, isn't it? You know, what this reminds me of? It's like in any catastrophe, in any accident, say a car accident, one person might be decapitated and the other person will be fine. Yeah, you know, one person may be completely unharmed and another person completely mangled.
Yeah.
And you would say, how could that be? But that happens in virtually every major accident. One person is perfectly okay.
Yeah.
Okay, occasionally everyone's killed. But, I mean, it's very common. And it's just because that's, I guess, physics. And that's just the way things happen.
Yeah, certain randomness of things.
Yeah. It's hard for our minds and our emotions to deal with some of that. And I think if you look at Dave von Kleist's film, which I was very critical of that film when it came out, because what I saw him doing was a deceptive style of journalism where he showed you things and tried to make out that this was impossible. Like, I mean, he showed you, like, oh, you know, look inside the Pentagon there. None of those desks have been burned. And you think about it, but the way he describes it, oh, this is impossible. But you look at the way a real event occurs, well, it's inconsistent. Things aren't going to happen uniformly in every different direction. And I did get a strong sense with the Dave von Kleist film that it was deliberately blowing things up into a kind of a mystery, kind of like a UFO movie style, you know.
Yeah, the failure of things to get ignited in the Pentagon, of course, reminds me of the way the fuel behaved in the towers, that most of the fuel went straight through the towers and came out the other side and burnt outside the towers.
Right, yes.
And within 5 seconds, there was no more fire outside the towers. Within 5 seconds, the fire is out. Now, if much the same thing happened in the Pentagon, with the impact, the fuel would be dispersed, would ignite, and as it ignites, it expands and blows upwards out through the top of the building. It may only have been actually flames there in that particular region for a couple of seconds, not quite long enough to ignite material. You know, you can put your hand in a flame for a second or two, can't you, without it actually being burnt?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Your hand in
the flame? Let alone ignited.
Sure, it'll be hot, sure.
Yeah, look.
Yeah, the thing is, I've looked at quite a lot of the arguments that people have produced to say that the Pentagon could not have been hit by a 757, and every one of them seems to fall flat when you really look at it. So my conclusion is that you cannot prove that 757 did not hit the Pentagon. It can't be proved. And if you can't prove it, then it's best to stop talking about it for reasons we've already covered.
Sure, but I mean, but haven't you, like, for example, resorted to two different, like, mutually exclusive hypotheses to explain two different photographs?
You're talking about the explosive? Well,
no,
let's say there wasn't an explosive. Maybe,
no,
that, you know, merely that the tail fin, which is very weak, hit between the windows and didn't hit a window. So perhaps it's not hard enough to break the wall.
But you can understand people's actual, you know, suspicion.
Oh, yes, suspicion. But it's not proof. The fact that the wall wasn't all glass, it was only partially windows with solid walls in between. I don't know how high up that wall had been reinforced, but don't forget this was the reinforced wall. This is the one wall of the Pentagon that was reinforced. Now, you know, isn't it a little bit strange that the Al-Qaeda would have knew so much about what was going on, would have picked the one wall that was reinforced to hit. And it had few occupants, very few occupants, because the renovation had only just been completed and it had very few occupants. Now, did Al-Qaeda want to minimize the deaths? Doesn't make sense. It's just like the towers. If it was Al-Qaeda that put the explosives in, why did they put explosives all the way up and bring the tower down from the top? Why didn't they put in a little bit of sneaky explosive down at the bottom and tip the tower over sideways?
Yeah.
Was it because they wanted to reduce the damage to the real estate? Why would Al-Qaeda have wanted to reduce damage to the real estate? So, you know...
Sure, but can I just talk about that... You know those videos we saw, like, you know, about 5 years ago? They started showing this plane that actually hit the wall of the Pentagon and sort of seemed to remain intact and cut, you know, and just... And it flew through intact and managed to cut all the support columns. Like, we see this video, you know, animation of this plane's wings cutting all the support columns.
So I've seen the animation produced by NIST. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. I mean, that's sort of... But that's sort of... Isn't that kind of like... mutually contradictory the other with the story of, you know, the plane breaking up when it hits the wall?
Well, I'd just like to make a quick point in there, because I did watch the animation, that one of the early ones that was done by that guy who's actually done work for NIST, and he did work for the investigation into the Oklahoma bombing. I think his name is Meet Sozin. Does that name ring a bell? Well, he did an animation which purports to show the plane going into the building. And however, his animation does not match the actual data in the ASC report at all. His animation shows the entire plane going into the building, wings and all. And, you know, the ASC report proved that only one third of one wing and two thirds of the other wing could have gone into the building because of the actual maximum width of the actual, you know, hole. So, you know, there was a large hole at the bottom, of course. There was quite a large hole, but it still wasn't anyway near wide enough for the entire plane to fit in. But Meet Sozin's animation does show the entire plane fitting in, which is deceptive. And that doesn't prove one way or the other, but it's deceptive. Are you familiar with that one, Frank?
No, I'm not. I'm more familiar with the one of NIST with the airplane flying into the towers. I think that's fairly realistic animation. I think they did some remarkable work and they spent a lot of money doing that.
Right.
But it's all just part of the cover-up.
Right.
They spent all their money making the whole thing seem realistic, and yet the actual essence of it was wrong. The towers were brought down by explosives.
Absolutely.
And that they refused to consider.
Sure, but...
They did an awful lot of stuff that was good, and I think that some of their animations were correct. Of course, the animation for Building 7 is totally ridiculous. If you had a look at that, it's just collapsing all over the place, whereas we know the building came down very neatly.
Yeah, in their version of Building 7, it kind of looks like it's bending inwards.
Yeah, buckling and twisting around the place, which
Absolutely.
Shows that it's completely false. And I think they had a problem with Building 7 because their animation did not include a period of time in which the roof came down at free fall speed, and they resisted the idea of free fall speed for a very long time until the death knell, and that was because they knew that it contradicted their animation, and they had to admit it in the end.
Absolutely. Look, I think we've really covered as much ground as we can on this question of, you know, some of these like important issues about what happened at the Pentagon. But I want to just take a short break. And when we come back, I want to look at what we should be focusing on. What is the best case? Because this is really what we have to be. I mean, we're in a serious activity here of trying to bring truth and justice. So we're not really that concerned about whether we can prove one or the other thing, unless it's of value in our ultimate goal. That's where I think we should be coming from. So look, I'm just going to take a short break for some music. Are you good to continue, Frank?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, excellent. Okay, we're just going to take a short break for some music here. Mercy.
But I
You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Well, welcome back to Truth News Radio Australia. It's my great pleasure tonight to be talking to Dr. Frank Legg and my relatively frequent guest, Dan Collins. And we are talking about 9/11. We're talking about some issues in regard to the Pentagon. And I just want to really get into something that I just feel this is very important, and that anyone listening to this show should understand that for me, and I think for everyone else that who's involved in this movement, is that this is about truth and justice. This is not about being conspiracy theorists sitting around and saying who can prove this or who can prove that. We have a situation of a military-industrial complex that is out of control. And we have a government now that has retained the defense secretary from the previous administration. I mean, what better evidence is there than that the Pentagon is really running things? And the military campaigns are nonstop. The killing is nonstop. Children are being blown up, napalmed, call it what you will. You know, they're being massacred. And it's all being done in our names because we are part of it. Australia is part of it. And 9/11 was the justification for all of it. As Obama said last week, he gave a speech, and it was only a couple of days ago I heard it. He was saying it's all because of 9/11. Did you catch that one, Frank?
I didn't hear it, but I know that he has supported
the
official story on 9/11.
He said it even just a few days ago. It's all because of 9/11, and that's why we have to now double the troops in Afghanistan, and just in case, because the Taliban want to do another 9/11. They're just waiting. They're just waiting their chance to do some other terrible thing. And all we're trying to do here is, you know, explain what we know, so we can then get subpoena power to find out what really happened, because what we know is enough to prove that they're lying to us. And they're definitely lying to us about what happened at the Pentagon, but we don't know exactly all of the different lies they're telling us. But let's focus on what we know they're lying us about. How about, like, let's now focus on what we know they're lying to us about.
Yes, well, we can certainly very easily do that. We don't know everything, but there's one very, very crucial piece of information that was given to us by Norman Mineta, the Minister for Transportation. That's a pretty well-known story now, but maybe some people haven't heard it, so I'll just mention it. When he came down into the emergency bunker underneath the White House, which is called the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, PEOC, he found that Cheney was already there. And then a few minutes later, a young man came in and said, "The plane is 50 miles out." And he came in later and said, "The plane is 30 miles out." And then when it got down to 10 miles out, the young man also said to the vice president, "Do the orders still stand?" And Cheney said they did. And then a few minutes later, there was this terrible thing that happened at the Pentagon. Now, the only interpretation you can put on that is that Cheney had it in his hand to shoot that plane down and had given an order that the plane not shot down. Now, the next thing that we notice is that when it came to the 9/11 Commission, Cheney lied and said he was not there. He was not there in the PEOC at the time. Now, all he could have been doing is trying to exonerate himself and protect himself from the idea that he had anything to do with the events of that morning. And, of course, that means that if he didn't have anything to do with it, maybe it was Al-Qaeda. But obviously, the fact that he was there and lied about it is it's a prima facie case that he has to be investigated and looked into.
Indeed. And look, the testimony of Norman Mineta was, of course, struck from the 9/11 Commission record. And then it was claimed that he was wrong, that he'd made a mistake, that he'd got the times wrong.
And but of course, he stands by everything he said. More recently, he was approached by, I think, We Are Change Group, and he was questioned, and he reasserted everything, and he was very clear about it. And it, the video that I saw, he was absolutely adamant. So he's thought about this. He knows what he's talking about. He has blown the whistle on something that went on there.
That's exactly right. Yes, I have heard the second video, and he hasn't retracted.
Absolutely. So that is something that we can nail them on. Okay, there's something very, very inconsistent here that hasn't been explained. Okay. Now, there's also a lot of other independent corroboration that Cheney was in the command bunker. Now, I don't actually have it all at my fingertips, but I know that there's a lot of different information that's come along to place Cheney in that bunker during the approach time. Is there anything else that you can raise there, Frank?
Yes, I think there is somewhere in the literature. There is, in fact, there might even be a book written
yes.
by one of the officials that was there at the time.
Right.
One of the guys who was in charge of terrorist, I forget his name now, in charge of terrorist operations. yes, there is no doubt that there is other corroborative evidence. There's also things like the fact that Dave Frasca apparently blocked emails coming from Williams to the FBI.
Right.
And by blocking them, it enabled the higher-ups to claim, because they didn't know about it, about the fact that these fellows were training to fly and not learning to take off or land.
Okay.
Now, there are quite a lot of little things which, one by one, don't perhaps make a great deal of a case, but when you put them all together, it's very considerable.
Now, there's another piece of information which I find quite amazing, which has been confirmed by CNN, that directly above the White House, around about the time the plane hit the building, there was that enormous military 747, was it the E-4B, or I'm not sure if I got the name right. It's the same plane as Air Force One, with bristling with communication systems and, you know, military strike capabilities, that was definitely directly above Washington in the vicinity of the White House.
Yes, there is a video of that, and there's a paper on that in the Journal of 9/11 Studies.
Now, it's interesting that has never been explained.
E-4 is an electronic, F-4 Phantom, which has been converted to electronic warfare. It's a different plane.
The one I'm talking about is actually a 747. So it's a converted 747. It's a very, very large plane.
Yeah.
A communications plane.
Yeah, it's a communications plane. And so it was, it's just that, well, they never explained it. Now, even though it was reported on CNN and everything, the government just remains mute. You know, leave us to speculate. Yeah, well, this is, you know, okay, we know it was there, all right? So, and also, as far as I know, correct me if I'm wrong, there were no warnings given to anyone in the Pentagon that the plane was about to hit them. There were warnings after the plane hit, and there were warnings in the White House, but no one in the Pentagon was actually warned. Is that right, Frank?
Oh, it's true, and of course,
it's incredible.
It raises the level of speculation about what was in the reinforced wing too, because that was occupied by auditors who were studying the question of where some trillions of dollars of military money had gone to. And most of those auditors were killed. And so again, would you wonder why Al Qaeda would want to kill auditors?
Right, right.
It's another line of attack.
That's certainly interesting. Yeah. Of course, there's the point is often brought up that the plane struck a part of the building which was not, you know, fully occupied and had been recently reinforced, which did limit the damage. You know, the damage was less, much less than it might have been. And of course, Cheney and Rumsfeld and all the top generals completely safe. They were on the other side of the building.
You could ask a pretty interesting question there. Has the rest of the Pentagon been reinforced since?
Well, that's
or
a very good
just
point.
That side?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think it has. Why did they do that one side?
That is
pretty suspicious.
That is a very good point.
The most suspicious thing overall is the fact that explosives were obviously used to bring down all three towers on that day.
Yes.
But no investigation of explosives was taken by NIST.
Yes.
Now, it's the combination. It is not the explosives in themselves. It is the fact that NIST blatantly and very obviously refused to examine explosives, which proves their guilt. NIST is guilty. They are part of it. No doubt about it whatsoever. And anybody that tries to write to NIST and say, look, I think you made a mistake, is wasting their time, because the main people in NIST know that explosives were used. They have to know.
And what does that teach us about the Pentagon, though? Because, I mean, they're two different events. You could say, well, whatever NIST did, whatever NIST said about the Twin Towers, it's irrelevant in terms of looking at the Pentagon. But
If they will lie about the towers, they will lie about the Pentagon.
Right, right.
The whole thing, I see the Pentagon activity as twofold, really. On the one hand, they wanted to kill the auditors. And on the other hand, they wanted to create theatre to make everybody scared. And it worked very, very well.
Well, yes, I think the attack on the Pentagon really made it seem like a war had started.
Yes, they wanted a war.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they wanted.
Yeah.
And, of course, they wanted a war, and logically, if bin Laden had been behind this, they would have made efforts to have him captured and brought to trial. But instead of that, they engaged in an invasion of Afghanistan, which is completely the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, this is again the bigger picture, the whole geopolitical picture, which shows an intention, it shows an agenda. It's so clear. I mean, most people can see it. You know, many people I've spoken to who've never done any actual investigation can see that intuitively. They know something fishy is going on. I mean, we're just in this position of being forced to try and prove point by point what we can. I'd just like to look at the question of how the plane was piloted, assuming it was a plane. I mean, we'll just assume that it was a plane for the time being. So what do we know about Hani Hanjour? Was he capable of doing that that amazing 180-degree or 270-degree spiral turn with such perfect precision?
Everybody talks about it being perfect, but if you look at the animation, which I think is probably pretty accurate, the animation is skewed. It makes the plane appear to come from the wrong direction.
Oh, that's interesting.
And also it sets the plane up as too high. But apart from those two clear errors,
yes,
it seems to be pretty real. And
yes,
I think that if you watch it carefully, you will see pretty strange things. On that descent, you will see the plane descending rather steeply, then levelling off and going up a tiny bit, then going down, going up and down. It's not very perfect at all.
Okay,
I think they're bloody lucky to hit the thing. I think it's quite on the cards that the plane was piloted by a human.
Right.
Even though you can make a very, very strong argument that because it was such an important thing that they couldn't entrust it to a human, they would have to use an onboard device to take over the autopilot.
Okay.
Now, it looks very, very likely that that would be the case, and yet the behaviour of the plane is very much like it's under human control. There are two occasions where the autopilot appears to be switched off and the plane leaps up and, you know, gains a couple of thousand feet, then drops again and up and down.
Okay, yeah.
It doesn't look like autopilot control. But then, on the other hand, you could say, well, the perpetrators might have been very clever and they might have built into the controlling device a period where it behaved in a random fashion as though it was being controlled by an inexperienced human.
Sorry, is this from the radar data or the
Both. The data, the animation has got two sets of data in it. One is the pressure altitude, the other is the radar data.
This is from
radar altitude.
Sorry, the black box that they recovered, yeah. supposedly. Yeah. I mean, do you really put 100% faith in that? Or?
Pardon?
Oh, this supposed black box data they recovered.
Yes. What about it?
Well, I mean, do you put 100% faith that, you know, they genuinely actually found the actual black box and just put it out to the public?
No, I'm certain they found the black box, and it's quite on the cards that the data that was given to the pilots to 9/11 Truth was based on the black box data, but it wasn't necessarily the exact data. It's very likely manipulated in one way and another. And in fact, the animation is clearly false, because if you start at the Pentagon and work backwards to find out where the plane took off, you find it's miles away from the airport.
Right.
It's clearly false. It's coming at the wrong angle.
That's interesting.
It's also too high. It couldn't possibly have hit the Pentagon from where the data finishes.
Now, is that altitude problem possibly just a question of incorrect adjustment for pressure or whatever?
No, I don't believe it is. No, right. I think that's been fairly carefully checked out by pilots for 9/11 Truth. I think they've got it right that it's really wrong.
Right, yeah.
And they were so certain it was wrong that they applied to the National Transport Safety Bureau to get more data, and they got a raw data file. Now, the raw data file has the plane coming from the right direction. It's coming in line with the power poles and the damage in the Pentagon.
Okay.
But it's still too high. And there is some evidence that it's been manipulated a bit at the end.
Right.
And also, it's a very interesting point, you see. This is where Pilot 7... Pilots for 9/11 Truth makes a very big case. They say it is impossible for the plane to fly over an antenna, which is further back, and still come down and hit the power pole, the light poles, because if it had done that, the pullout would have smashed the plane. It just couldn't have stopped its descent.
Oh, okay.
But
right.
The pilots for 9/11 Truth failed to do is examine the question of whether the plane could have been coming in just a few feet off to one side and missed that antenna.
Yeah.
If it had missed the antenna, it would have been flying lower and wouldn't have had to pull up so much. Mightn't have had to pull up at all. It might have been on a straight line descent towards the Pentagon. So they don't actually prove that flight path was impossible.
I see.
And they're very, very careful to say that they take no position on whether the 757 hit the Pentagon.
Okay, well, that sounds sensible.
They really do point out quite clearly that the altitude is wrong, and if the altitude is wrong, why wouldn't the heading be slightly wrong, just a few feet out?
Yeah.
You know, why trust the heading? I think it's quite reasonable to suspect that the plane. In fact, you know, if you take on board the idea that the plane really did hit the Pentagon, it's just a question of finding out whether there is a path that the plane could have approached that would not have created G-forces too severe for the plane structure. And I suspect that there is such a path. It hasn't been proved that there isn't, anyway. If anybody's examined it, they haven't published it. They haven't published the fact that it's impossible to do it.
Right.
So I suspect that, you know, it's one of these things that you can't prove, we can't prove sitting here, that the flight path to the Pentagon is impossible.
Can we just talk a little more about Honey Hunjour? Because I, you know, this to me seems always one of the weakest points, because of his obvious ineptness. He's physically really small. He's about 5 feet tall. Which just also makes you wonder how they, you know, overpowered the pilots and stuff. But
he wasn't alone, of course.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you don't really know that he's on board the plane. There's no TV footage.
Yeah.
His name isn't on the manifest. There's no DNA proving he was there. He could just be some kind of a patsy. His job it was to take the scent away from the right person.
Yeah.
There were quite a lot of these people wandering around in Florida learning how to fly, and how do you know, maybe they were pretending to fly worse than they really could. But, you know, there were so many unknowns. But the point is that it's quite possible that the plane wasn't flown by Hany Hamidjour at all.
Yeah.
It was flown by an onboard device who was hijacked by this device, and he was powerless to change its course. So the fact that he was a poor pilot really doesn't provide any evidence that the plane couldn't have hit the Pentagon.
No, it doesn't, but it provides evidence that the official 9/11 commission story of what happened is not plausible. That he himself piloted that plane into the building.
Even that is disputable. I mean, are you aware of the mode, the autopilot mode called control wheel steering?
Oh, well, I've heard something about this. I think John Bursell's mentioned it a couple of times. Can you just fill us in on that?
Right. Well, it differs from normal autopilot management in that normally you set headings or set a destination, and the plane will fly to that destination or fly at that altitude and so forth.
Yes.
And it just goes on doing it until you tell it to do something different. You know, you reset it.
Yes.
And if you look at an animation, you'll see the plane flies extremely smoothly. But in this other one, in this other mode, the CWS mode, what the pilot has to do is simply press a button and the plane will continue to do what it's doing. So if he aims it in a certain direction,
right,
the plane will then hold it. Now, if after a while the pilot thinks, I'm not quite going in the right direction, he just needs to press his little button and nudge the control column a little bit to turn the plane slightly, ever so slightly,
right,
and then let the button go again, and the plane will then carry on exactly as it's heading.
How now, do you explain a spiral turn, though? How does that create?
If you look at the animation, you'll see that there was no. That's all over the place. It's wobbly. It doesn't look like it's got much. It starts off extremely wobbly with variations right. in altitude of a couple of thousand feet, and then it gradually settles down, like an inexperienced human, gradually getting the hang of it, you know, and it's smoothed down. But then a very important point to note is in the last 1.5 minutes of that animation, the plane's motion stabilizes. And I think it's conceivable, I'm not saying it happened, but it's conceivable that the pilot turned on the autopilot in CWS mode at that point, 1.5 minutes before impact,
right,
and then used the autopilot to direct the plane pretty straight now. He's finished his turn. He's just coming in pretty straight. And he just nudges it a little bit. And if you look at the pressure altitude graph, you'll see it has just got little tiny deviations in it. It's no longer doing random motions. It's just little adjustments. And it's quite conceivable that in that period, that last 1.5 minutes, a quite inexperienced pilot could have been holding the plane on course. The plane itself, the autopilot doing the majority of the work, keeping the wings level and the attitude correct and so forth, and just nudging it in the direction. So it wouldn't matter how shaky he was, it didn't show up on the motion of the plane. It's quite conceivable. I don't say it happened. So, you know, it's just another one of those things that you can't prove.
Right. I mean, I guess the question here is, you know, in my mind, you know, well, the government says these attacks were carried out by 19 men acting totally independently, and we know from their background they were not very skilled. Some of them had more levels of skill than others, but you know they certainly weren't experienced pilots. And you know we're just looking for I'm looking for anything that I can
they worked for the U.S. government
confirm that says well this is not this doesn't fit in with what I've been told.
They were trained at Pensacola. It had to be good.
Obviously, what was done there with that plane hitting the Pentagon. It's certainly, if it was lucky, it was pretty damn lucky. That's all I can say. I mean, it was very, very lucky if it was just luck.
Yeah, one of the things that some people say is that it's impossible that it was done by these inexperienced pilots because they did it so accurately. Well, now, I can argue against even that because if you look at the South Tower, The impact mark shows that the plane was banking steeply to the left, suggesting that it made a last-minute, you know, a last-second correction to try to get back on track.
Yeah.
And even though it made that correction to the left, it still hit too far to the right and did something to some explosives inside the tower, apparently, because you can see red-hot metal pouring out of the tower. Now,
yeah,
the perpetrators couldn't have wanted that to happen. So it looks like that was almost a bad hit.
Yeah.
And in the case of the Pentagon, the blooming thing hit the light poles and practically touched the ground. You can't tell me that that was where they really wanted to hit it. It's just too risky. If it had been another couple of feet lower, it might have crashed, not got
right.
there.
Right.
So I think that that plane was actually flying at the very lower limit of its possible error, and its target was probably several metres higher.
Okay.
It was really right out of, you know, really long way away from its correct target point. So I don't think the accuracy is very high. Only the North Tower was reasonably accurate, or appears to be reasonably accurate. We don't know where they were aiming for in the North Tower either. It might have been miles off.
Well, sorry, Frank. Can I ask just one question? To turn the question around, could you actually think of any one thing which would actually prove that a plane hit the Pentagon? Have we ever been shown any piece of evidence that, like?
No, I mean there are photographs of parts of a 757, but they could have been faked. They could have been somewhere else, taken somewhere else. And we don't have much in the way of testimony. I've only got personally one testimony of a man who said he was working there and found large parts of an aeroplane underneath the Pentagon. And I can't publish that because I've asked him if he would allow me to quote him, but he won't. He hasn't replied.
An aeroplane, I mean, what? I mean, there's been all kinds of theories about, like, a military jet hitting the Pentagon.
Well, no, he wouldn't be able to tell whether it was a military jet or a 757. But, of course, the people who did the study, the NTSB, would have pieces of the airplane which they would be able to identify, but they don't release the information. So, no, there's no... there's just so much evidence which the plane did hit. I mean, if you look at the damage underneath the Pentagon, all those columns being broken and bent. They're bent and broken in the direction of the exit hole. Now, some people say the exit hole is too circular. It must have been done by a missile. It's far too big to have been done by a missile. Couldn't that
just have been done by just? I mean, I had a theory. I still think it's quite possible that they actually, you know, it was a controlled demolition at the Pentagon, and they just.
Yeah, but
you know how it's much easier to actually demolish a steel building because it's very, you know, it's very well known, you know, the parameters are very well known, but the problem with concrete, I mean, and a lot of people who work in demolition will tell you from my experience that you never know what you're going to get with concrete. So it was like the Sands Casino, you know, when they just went kaboom and the thing just stood up because they couldn't see inside the concrete to see how much rebar was in the thing, so they didn't know exactly how much explosives to use. And, you know, and I think that's my theory, that, like, the wall of the Pentagon stood up because they miscalculated how much explosive to use.
Yeah, you mean the inner wall?
Well, I mean,
the C-ring, the hole in it.
No, the front wall, the facade.
The front wall. No, I don't think the front wall did stand up. I think there was a big enough hole in there to admit the engines and the bottom of the aeroplane, the heavy parts of the aeroplane.
But I mean, the front wall was still standing after the explosion
for a short time. Yeah, for about half
an
hour.
But there was a hole in it, big enough for the airplane's heavy parts to fit through.
Look, I think we're probably.
Something I'd like to ask you, Frank, about do you know of anyone who's actually addressed the issue of, like, the whole? I mean, even, you know, in the World Trade Center buildings and everything, about the failure mode. I mean, how did, like, you know, steel buildings are made to, you know, fail in a ductile manner. And,
yep.
I mean, how did these steel buildings suddenly perform like a glass building that's sort of shot with the bullet?
I think that question's a little bit off topic for tonight, and we're sort of running towards the end of the show, and I don't want to get too taken off into a tangent because we sort of need to wrap up. But if you want to address that briefly, Frank, go ahead.
Well,
Well, it's just the mode of failure.
I would just say, look at the work of David Chandler, who's got some very lucid and very brief videos showing how you can expect a smooth downward acceleration of the building if you use explosives. But, it's a long story, and I wouldn't want to break into that right now.
Yeah, look, I think I just want to read here from the summary of your article here at the end. You've said the evidence for what hit the Pentagon is contradictory. It is likely that contradictory evidence has been deliberately provided. There are some who assert that there was not enough debris for a plane crash and that a plane could not have penetrated as far as the observed damage. However, the plane would only have had to destroy part of one wall for most of its material to be able to slide among the support columns. There is photographic evidence of plane parts that are undeniably from a 757. There is evidence of a powerful explosion which would have changed the structure of the plane and its impact marks. If a missile had been involved, something else must have been involved as well to make these marks and to damage the light poles. If a 757 was involved, there are three competing and contradictory stories about its flight path. How are we to deal with this confusion? And two essential points you finish off with are, one, nothing should have hit the Pentagon, because the Pentagon is obviously the most important military installation in the United States. This implies a stand-down order existed, as appears to be confirmed by Mineta's testimony. And two, the authorities could easily show us what hit the Pentagon, but they do not. Together, these provide prima facie evidence that the official explanation of the event at the Pentagon is false and that a cover-up exists. This is more than sufficient to demand a new investigation, regardless of what hit the Pentagon. Now, I love that. I love the way you finished that.
Yeah, well, my latest version of the paper says exactly the same thing, so... But that's really what I wanted to write the paper about, the fact that it doesn't matter what hit the Pentagon, there's a case for a new investigation.
Hear, hear.
That's what we've got to do. Somehow we've got to get it. Are you aware that there's a new group forming called Scientists for 9/11 Truth?
I haven't heard of that one, actually. No, that's that sounds terrific. Okay.
The aim is to try and get a body of scientists who are of the opinion that a new investigation is required, and... Sign, the only criterion to be a member is that you sign a petition saying that you're suspicious of the events and that you want a new investigation and that you are a scientist.
I'm a scientist.
So there's plenty of people could sign that.
That is, I'm definitely going to look out for that. Is it got a website yet?
Not yet.
Okay. No,
they're trying to find a volunteer to create the website.
Excellent.
Heroin.
You'll be there soon.
I've got my hands very full, but I'd love to help in any way I can. We've sort of come to the end of our allotted time for tonight. We're really thankful for having you on the show tonight, Frank. As always, you know, it's excellent. You're one of the most balanced people that we get a chance to talk to. Will you be coming to Sydney for the Hard Evidence Conference?
Yes, I will.
Great. We'll be seeing you there. Thanks, Dan, for participating. And
pleasure.
I hope we've contributed something there. We just keep trying. That's the main thing. So, thank you again, Frank. And I hope to speak to you again at some point.
It's been a pleasure, Harold.
Thanks a lot, and good night.